So I would like to start by thanking Bridget and Clint for organizing this terrific conference. I have been having a lot of fun, and I know that many of you are in the same situation as I am. I would also like to thank them for giving me the opportunity to present our data today. And because I have been working for Bridget and Clint in the past, I feel even more compelled to follow the instructions, which I believe is probably the recipe for the success of this meeting every single time. So I'm going to be talking about how to fit atomic models into cryo-EM maps. And so Wa already mentioned many very important aspects. A couple of the slides might be overlapping, but I can skip and go faster if needed. So everybody knows here that single particle EM has become a very, very hot field. Many structures have attracted attention, and I think how does that work? Okay, the TRIBV1 channel that Ifan's lab reported a few years ago made a high-resolution structural determination famous outside of our field, and many, many people realized that that could be useful to them as well. A few years later, when Melody Campbell and myself were working in Bridget and Clint's lab, we broke the three-action barrier for the proteasome. But you see, although this is what we call high-resolution in EM, for crystallography standards, it's not that high resolution. It's kind of on the low end. And except for a few maps from Subramaniam's lab that came up to 1.8 angstrom, it's pretty rare to have maps in the 2-ish angstrom range or higher resolution. And so one of the way to go about it is to bridge the gap between the resolution in crystallography and the resolution in cryo-EM is to try to use computational methods to fill in the missing information. So ideally, when we determine a structure, once you have a cryo-EM map, we have heard all along the week how to get a good map. The goal of everybody will be to feed in a software, a map, and a sequence, and to get an atomic model that is fully refined, and then you can start interpreting. So with a bit more specifics, so the goal of the structural determination is to be able to position all the atoms in a structure. So we would like to correct errors in the model to improve the fit to the data. The model aims at representing our experimental data while agreeing with the stereochemical knowledge we have about proteins. So each atomic position in the PDB in a PDB file is described by four parameters, five if you include occupancy, but in the Cartesian system, three parameters define the coordinates and a temperature factor that I mentioned earlier. And so crystallographers like to think in terms of data to parameter ratio. So when you collect an X-ray diffraction data set, you measure diffracted intensities, and each measured intensity is an observation. So if a protein has 1,000 atoms, for example, you have four parameters, you have 4,000 parameters to refine. And how many observations do you have? And crystallography people aim at having an overdetermined system. You have many more observations than parameter to refine. And this is a situation that is favorable to avoid overfitting. So we don't really think in those terms in EM because we don't measure diffracted intensities. But it's always good to keep that in mind. And the final goal is obviously to get a structure and to understand what the function is, the biology carried out by this molecule. So if one is lucky enough to get a protein, diffract X-rays, or maybe one day single particle reconstruction, at what is so-called ultra-high resolution, you can see that individual atoms are defined in the map, and you need very, very little knowledge. You just need to know how the atoms are connected to each other in amino acid residue to build a model. You can even avoid using any restraints. A typical resolution achieved in X-ray crystallography is 2 angstrom, and people are able to build atomic models, although we don't see atoms. And the reason for that is, again, we use stereochemical knowledge such as bond length and bond angles or sterics to be able to guide the refinement along with the data. At 4 angstrom, which is a resolution much more common for cryo-EM work, you can see that it's even more difficult. Although you see a blob for a tyrosine here, it doesn't tell you much about, except the overall volume occupied by this tyrosine, how it should fit. So one can add additional terms in addition to what I mentioned previously, such as the distribution of torsion angles, the fact that protein adopt defined hydrogen bond patterns, electrostatic interactions, solvation, and so on. And these terms are very common in problem modeling, for example. So if we go back to the 0.5 angstrom resolution example, your data drives very easily, drives you towards a unique solution. And a very weak geometry potential is good enough to have convergence. And again, at 0.5 angstrom, you probably don't even need it. At 2 angstrom, your data is not uniquely defining the solution, so it's very useful to be able to supplement the missing information by stereochemical knowledge. And again, at 4 angstrom, you really need to use much more than that because your data do not define what is the unique solution at all. So one way to go about that, and this is mostly what I will be focusing, is these terms. We try to optimize the position of atoms to maximize or minimize the energy function, which is composed of a stereochemical term. Depending on the resolution, you can use any of the terms I mentioned, and an agreement with the data that is weighted, as you can see here. And the force field used in many crystallographic softwares can be replaced by the Rosetta energy function if you use Rosetta. And it's a way to fill in the gap of information that I was mentioning. So many softwares are available to do that, and I'm going to try to cite as many as possible, but I apologize in advance because I'm sure it's not exhaustive. So I think we all use UCSF Chimera, and we all like it to visualize maps when we just determine them with our favorite software. And I think it's very useful to also do rigid body docking. And I like it very much, but to look at maps in an overall global view, not really to look at small details. I prefer CUDA a lot to look at the map from very close. So when people in my lab tell me, I have processed with different subsets of data, and the map is better, or the map is not better, I say, how did you look at it? Say, Chimera. I say, I think you should look at it with CUDA, because you see a lot better when you're close. If you walk through the structure, you can see small differences in density. You can flip back and forth between 2, 3, 4 maps. And I think it's a lot easier to visualize fine details. But again, the two softwares are very useful for different applications. So RefMax, that has been developed at the University of York, and Gary Mershidov moved to the LMB a few years ago, has been very successful for crystallographic refinement. And I understand that he has made many, many developments with Alan Brown to make it very efficient for EM maps as well. I know people at the LMB have been using it with great success. Phoenix has also been making several developments. And Bridget told me recently that Tom Terwilliger recently added many features that I'm not going to be discussing because I could not really find them on the website. But apparently, Phoenix map to model is working very, very well with cryo-EM reconstructions now. Buccaneer has been around for a while for crystallography. And our experience is that it works very well if you have 3 angstrom or better. So for EM, it's not yet quite there. Pathwalker, that was detailed earlier today. Direx, also with a flexible fitting software, MDFF as well. Rosetta, that I mentioned earlier, and maybe plenty others that I have not described. And I apologize for that. So I'm going to describe the experience we have using Rosetta as a complete structure determination pipeline. And I would like to start by giving full credit to Frank DiMaio, who is a faculty member in my department, who has really been pioneering all the concept of introducing protein modeling to build into cryo-EM reconstruction. And thanks to the methods he developed, I think many of us have been benefiting from them. I know he has many collaborations or helped many people getting started with Rosetta. And I'm going to try to walk you through this pipeline, starting with de novo model building. So what Rosetta does differently from many other softwares is that on one hand, it uses an energy function with many more terms than typical crystallographic softwares. In addition to bond length, bond angles, you use the knowledge determined from high-resolution structures. You know that hydrophobic amino acids are buried in the core of a protein, electrostatic interactions need to be satisfied, and hydrogen bonding patterns are also clearly defined in proteins. And it's not very favorable to have non-partnered hydrogen bond donors or acceptors. Rosetta also uses torsion angle probabilities, which is much more common, and many crystallographic softwares use that. I know Phoenix has the possibility to use that as well. But on the other hand, the main breakthrough beside the energy function is to use the concept that the local sequence dictates the local structure. This is a concept that was used for protein modeling when you try to predict a structure in the absence of any data. But you can also use that with data, and it's actually much easier, obviously, to converge toward the right solution. And I'm going to describe that concept in a couple of slides, but this is really central of how Rosetta works. So building a structure de novo at 3 to 5 angstrom resolution is not that easy, especially because regions of the maps are better than others. And so far, many of us are doing it, have been doing it by manual tracing. And not only it takes time, but also in crystallography, this is not the way it's done. When people determine a structure, they just feed it to a software to auto-build the model that is complete at the end of the day between 50 and 90%, and they just polish it manually and refine it. So why should we spend our time? I think, again, because probably I worked with Bouget and Klein for a while, and similarly to Legendon, why would you spend your time doing something if a computer can do it just as well? And during that time, you can do something that a computer cannot do for you. So the reason why crystallographic softwares have not worked very well so far, although there are many developments, and so I just, as I said, Phoenix seems to be working very well now. I have not seen by myself, but the assignment of the sidechain position is really based on the sidechain density, mostly. And the sidechain density is not that good at this kind of resolution, and this explains why a lower resolution than 3 angstrom is sometimes difficult to get these softwares to work. So how Rosetta works is to use, again, this concept, local structure dictates local sequence, dictates local structure. So given a small fragment of the sequence of your protein of interest, and you're going to use gliding windows, 9 residue fragments centered around a given residue, will allow you to predict the conformational space that is available to this 9 residue fragments. And you can generate tons of fragments by scanning the PDB for fragments with similar sequence and predicted secondary structures. And these fragments can be docked into the density. You do that for a bunch of fragments, and you try, obviously you get a lot of false positive, and you try to filter them, select them, based obviously on the agreement to density, but also reasonable metrics such as 2 different residues cannot occupy the same position, and 2 fragments assigning the same residue to the same position should strongly be favored because it's convergence. A closability score has also been added, which is when you are trying to build a model, the distance between 2 extremities should not be larger than what is observed in the PDB, otherwise you have a penalty, and the shorter the number of residues in between, the higher the penalty to pay. So the energy function includes all of these terms, and the Monte Carlo simulated annealing allows to select fragments that are optimizing the energy function, as is described here with all these terms. And Frank showed a few years ago that he works up to 4.8 angstrom resolution. He was able to use that to determine a complete model of the T20S proteasome. That was a test case that was determined in Ifan's lab. They were computed with fewer particles, a 4.8 angstrom map, which I have to say is a very good map. It's a 4.8 angstrom map that probably the best I have ever seen. So maybe 4.8, let's say 4.5 is still a good target to aim for. But so the fragments corresponding to T20S proteasome and all related proteins were removed from the database of fragments, obviously. Otherwise, you're just recapitulating what has already been found. And that worked very well to build a model. So in my lab, we used it successfully many, many times. And last year, we determined the structure of coronavirus spike protein in the pre-fission conformation that you can see here. And so we built a model in parallel using Rosetta de novo and manual tracing. And we agreed most of the time. But I have to say that Rosetta de novo is pretty fast. And sometimes it was providing us seeds that we could that was faster than what we were doing by hand. It's a very large protein with each protomer containing 1,300 amino acid residues. And we had more than 800 residues with no structural information. So that worked very well, and we were happy. And more recently, we also used it to help us seed model building of the same protein in the so-called post-fission conformation. So the protein refolds to allow fusion of the viral and host membranes during infection. And this is what allows the infection to initiate. So just as a digression, this is the exact same protein sequence in 2 different conformations. The conformational changes of that magnitude are not that common. So Rosetta de novo does not always work, especially in loop regions and beta sheet regions. And we had two domains on the periphery of the spike that we could not build by hand, and Rosetta de Novo was also struggling, came up with one fragment. And really, helices are very easy to build, and Rosetta de Novo does very well in most cases, but sometimes loops and strands are going to fail. And the nine residue window fragment imposes to have all the backbone, the residue in this fragment with a proper backbone conformation to have a good energy signal. And that's a bit difficult sometimes. So Frank DiMaio and Brandon Frenz, a graduate student in his lab, developed a new method that is called enumerative sampling. And it is using a related concept, but the fragments are only three residue long. And the idea behind that is that we have probably not observed all the nine residue fragment structure possible in nature in the PDB, but we have most likely observed all the three residue fragments. So you can predict much better with three residue fragments how to complete a model. So this is not really applicable for building a complete model, but once you have a virtually complete model that Rosetta de Novo produced, you can use that. So it is using a greedy conformational strategy to complete the model, and it has worked very, very well with models up to with gaps up to 110 residues. Sometimes multiple gaps at the same time can be dealt with. So the way it works is that in blue you see your partial model, and you try to grow from an extremity. You have a set of short fragments added of three residues, and you select the best fragments. But you don't select one, you select multiple. It's called a beam search, in which at each iteration you carry multiple solutions, and so on and so forth. And until you repeat the steps until you have completed the model, and you see you have multiple models until the end. And to make this procedure very efficient, Brandon implemented three terms in the energy function. One that penalizes the densities when you build a model across different regions of densities without continuity, which is obviously not a good sign. The explicit modeling of beta sheet is that when a fragment is added and it is in the beta region of the Ramachandran plot, it starts modeling beta sheets on either side, on both sides of your fragments, if density allows to do it. And the conformation of the backbone is actually a very good driver to help the modeling of these regions. And finally, for computational efficiency, the sidechains are usually represented with a centroid function at the center of gravity of the sidechain. But at the last step, you explicitly add all atoms of the sidechain to be able to use the sidechain information, which is pretty weak usually at 3 to 5 angstrom. But sometimes cases like that, you have very useful information allowing to encode the sequence into the density. So this method is pretty independent of B-factor sharpening. So it's another structure of a coronavirus spike protein we determine. And Brandon played around with different B-factor sharpening between 0, 100, 200, 300. And you can see the method. So we're looking at the RMSD toward the final model we obtain. And in a reasonable range, the method is largely independent of the sharpening factor you use, which is pretty convenient. So this is one example of a case that failed with Rosetta de Novo, the BPP1 structure determined in Hong Zhu's lab, and the Rosetta enumerative sampling, or ES, was able to complete this fragment, very long fragments, successfully. As you can see, multiple models are carried until the end, and you have trimming done at each iteration to only keep the best based on the criteria I just described. So in our case, we're back to our coronavirus spike proteins, the two domains on the periphery that were pretty poorly resolved and for which we were struggling. Rosetta de Novo found a 30 residue long fragment that seemed to agree with the density, but could not complete it, neither could we manually, and Rosetta ES completed the entire two domains. And so we had some nice fiducials telling us that the topology was likely correct, such as a disulfide bond accounted for by density, and it's a glycoprotein, so we are seeing extra density in front of an asparagine residue that is part of a glycosylation sequence, and we confirmed the presence of the glycan using mass spec. So all of that made us very happy. And the following year, or 6 months later, we solved another structure of a coronavirus spike protein at much higher resolution, in which we could resolve a domain that was not visible in the first map. But again, when you reach toward the C-terminal extremity, the resolution was decreasing and decreasing, and it was difficult to model the last 30 residues. So we just used Rosetta ES that came up with a very satisfactory solution, where hydrophobic side chains are well defined, obviously, in the density. But again, we had two glycans defining the density that we cross-validated using mass spec, telling us that it was probably the proper architecture. And now we determine more structures that are also in agreement with that. So as you understood, we are doing a lot of work with glycoproteins, and cryo-EM provides us a unique opportunity to keep the glycans on the protein and visualize them, although they are very flexible. Well, usually for crystallography, they are most of the time trimmed, not always, but most of the time, because they could prevent formation of crystal contacts. And Frank and Brandon developed tools to handle the glycans and refine them, including the automatic detection of your glycan moieties and the links between them, and it enforces the proper stereochemical conformation, which is a chair conformation for hexoses. So again, a small digression, John Aguirre's lab at the University of York analyzed the carbohydrates present in the PDB, and the standards were much, much lower than what we have for proteins. And he realized that most of the carbohydrates built on structures were more or less wrong due to the stereochemistry being not favored. So John Aguirre developed tools to cross-validate similarly to mole probity that I will be talking at the end of my talk. But again, why it is so important to enforce the stereochemistry is that even in a three-ish resolution structure, the glycans are much more poorly defined, as you can see here, for two reasons. First, they are very flexible. Second, they are chemically heterogeneous. We use mass spec, and we can see that at each position, you can have 10 or 15 different chemical entities attached to this residue. When you average all of that, obviously, at the end of the day, you're not going to get something that is very well defined. So we can build the residue because we know what the machinery is adding there. But the density doesn't uniquely define, obviously, which type of glycans it could have been otherwise. So a second part of the pipeline is if you start with a structure for which you know something about, you have domains that are available, sometimes multiple domains, Rosetta Comparative Modeling, or Rosetta CM, allows you to make use of that information. And I will be showing an example, but partial structures or multiple partial structures are very useful. You have a transmembrane protein with a cytoplasmic domain for which there are crystal structures of related proteins. The transmembrane domains, again, you have related proteins with structural information, but you don't really know if all of that fits your structure. So you can use all these structures and combine them to guide a rebuilding approach. This is used in combination with the fragment I mentioned, and you can totally tune how often you're going to pick fragments from the structure you provide, how often you want to use fragments from the database. All of that can be parameterized to your liking, and that works very efficiently. Rosetta CM is also a completion tool. So if you have a structure that is 70% built, you can provide it to Rosetta CM to complete. But now Rosetta ES seems to outperform Rosetta CM in most cases, so I would rather recommend to use Rosetta ES instead. But again, to make use of information from homology modeling, you can see that Rosetta CM, with resolution as low as 4.8 angstrom in the proteasome map, can recover the core packing of hydrophobic side chains. We're comparing in blue a crystal structure at high resolution at 1.9 angstrom, I believe, and in red, the structure built by Rosetta CM using 4.8 angstrom data. And all the fragments from the proteasome have been removed from the database, obviously. We have another example with a hydrogenase from Werner Kuhlbrand's lab. And you see that all atom RMSDs are around 2 angstrom. Usually, we talk about C-alpha or backbone RMSD in that region around 2 angstrom. So for all atom RMSD, it's a very, very good score. So an example of how we use Rosetta CM was for determining the structure of a cyclic nucleotide gated channel at around 4 angstrom resolution. And this work was done by Andrew Borst, who is here. And I hope you had a chance to stop by to his poster. As you can see on the class averages, the transmembrane domains show a lot of feature with individual helices, but the cytoplasmic domains are very, very flexible and blurred. So Andrew initially determined a structure at around 7 angstrom resolution, and we knew a lot about cation channels and potassium channels from the structure determined in Rod McKinnon's lab and others. And so we figured we're going to use this information, although our channel is pretty different. And what we knew is that potassium channels have a so-called domain-swapped architecture, where the pore domain that is located here is not directly interacting with a voltage sensor domain, but the projection, the S4-S5 linker or helix, is projecting away to allow to swap the architecture. So we took the structures available based on sequence identity, and we tried to dock these two domains And we realized there was no way to fit this domain swapped architecture in the structure because the connection between S4 and S5, instead of being a long helix, was pretty short. It was a 7-angstrom map, and we were a bit worried, although the density was convincing. So Andrew and I wrote an email to our collaborator, Bill Zagoda, who has been working on these channels for like 20 years. And he told me later that when he received the email with us suggesting the possibility of a non-swap architecture, his first reaction was to say, oh, they're not channel people. They don't know what they're talking about. And he looked at the map, and he said, oh, that's pretty convincing. And so later on, we were able to collect a new data set and improve the resolution to close to 4-angstrom, and that seemed pretty convincing. And in the meantime, Rod McKinnon's lab solved also structures and Schwemming's lab, and we all saw this new architecture that was non-swapped for these channels. So if you remember, I told you that the cytoplasmic domain were not as well defined because they are blurred, as we can see here. And despite we classified the data as much as we could, we never managed to get as good resolution for the cytoplasmic domain than for the transmembrane domain. And so we use Rosetta CM with the available crosstalk structures of the cytoplasmic domains. There is more than half a dozen. And here I'm showing the superimposition from the best half dozen models scored by Rosetta energy function and colored by the RMSD, the deviation between these different domains. This is the C-alpha RMSD, and what you can see is that, for example, the loops between the transmembrane domains are very, very variable, especially here. So we decided to just truncate them because we were really not confident about how to model them. And the cytoplasmic domain, although they are blue, it seems like they are pretty well defined. The backbone is well defined because although the resolution was lower, it's probably 6-angstrom, and it's enough to see helices and to model that region starting from known structures. But the side chains were all over the show, which is normal because they are not defined in the density. So we also decided to model that by truncating the position at the carbon beta to preserve the identity of the residues, but also to indicate that we were really uncertain about the sidechain assignments and even about the sequence registration. And we arbitrarily fixed the B factor to a very high value just to give clues to people who will use the structure. That region is really well poorly defined. So independently of how you built your model, the next step in the pipeline is the density-guided iterative refinements. So it is also making use of the fragments, so it allows to rebuild the region if needed, and the radius of convergence is very high. You can tune at that stage the length of the fragments you want to use. The longer the fragments, the more divergence from the initial model you're going to be able to obtain. And you can also target the refinement to regions of your liking. You can ask to focus on regions with conformational strength. And here we see an illustration where, for example, this phenylalanine side chain is kind of occupying the density, but the backbone is not properly located. There's probably a half residue offset. So the C beta position is clearly showing you that there's a problem, and Rosetta can go to these regions. But you can also select randomly the fragments to insert. You can define a region if you know everything is perfect, but a fragment of 20 residues, you can do that. And typically, we run many, many models in parallel, and we select them based on the Rosetta energy function and cross-validation. And that has been shown to allow determining models with atomic accuracy levels, again, using the information from probably modeling to fill in the missing information with resolution as low as 4.5-angstrom. So Frank recently implemented two other aspects, the voxel size refinement, because it's not always accurately determined on the microscope. And also the B factor refinement, I agree with Roy, it's very, very important. It's a very good way for us to express our uncertainty about parts of the model. And so usually in Rosetta, we do that at the very last step. You want to keep a constant B factor throughout the atoms to avoid decreasing the incentive of Rosetta to move some regions, because if you let the B factor go high, this explains why it doesn't fit the density, and the software is not going to try to do much about it anymore. So you keep it constant throughout the refinement, and at the last step, you do a B-factor refinement. So an example of what we use that for, we use it for all the projects, but I decided to take a different map just to show different applications. This 2.8-angstrom proteasome map that we determined with Melody Campbell a few years ago, and Rosetta was allowing us to automatically correct for sidechain rotamer positions. This is how it started from in the crustal structure, how it should be based on the density. And we could also resolve water molecules in this map, and Rosetta allows you to refine all of that, taking into account. And there is one loop. The main difference between the crustal structure at 1.9 angstrom and the cryo-EM reconstruction is localized in one loop. And I think everybody who worked with the T20S proteasome, which is probably half of the room, has seen that this loop is different. So this is the crustal structure fit, and this is totally outside of density. If you let Rosetta density-guided iterative refinement, you see it brings things back in density. And this is what I call a very large radius of convergence. Most crystallographic software will not be able to move atoms by that much. So a question that I oftentimes hear, how expensive from a computational standpoint is it to run Rosetta? So you can't run that on your laptop. I mean, you could for the final steps, but all the de novo building requires a cluster, a CPU-based cluster. And each job is a different trajectory. And typically, you want to run 100 to 1,000 for the density-guided iterative refinement, for example. So one CPU is one trajectory. And you select the best models. You can't look at 1,000 models in CUT. We just can't do that. But you can select the best 10, 12, typically, based on the Rosetta energy function, which includes agreement to density and to prior knowledge, but also the cross-validation with map model FSC. How am I doing? Okay. So the runtime depends, obviously, on the size of the model you want to build. And just to give you an idea, for Rosetta ES, in 1.5 hours using 16-core node, you can run a 30 residue fragment, the completion of a 30 residue fragment. For CM or density-guided iterative refinements, for a protein of about 100 kilodalton with threefold symmetries or 300 kilodalton or fourfold symmetry, it's going to be 2 to 4 hours approximately. And relax, which is the last step that I didn't mention, is just really a last minimization step and sidechain optimization. It takes 15, 20 minutes per model. The size doesn't matter too much. It's going to be 5 minutes versus 20 minutes, but it's not much. So I would like to bring something to your attention and ask if anybody in the room has experienced that. So at the University of Washington, our cluster is making use of what is so-called the backfill queue. So we all bind with nodes that are ours, but we can use other people's nodes when they are not using them. And as soon as they want them, when the owner comes, you are preempted instantly. So Rosetta has been, I mean, the cluster and Rosetta have been developed in agreement with each other, so it works very well for us for Rosetta. But for cryo-EM reconstruction, it doesn't work very well. If you just think of when we're running reliant on CPUs, you ask for 256 CPUs, and if you have just one person that claims the one CPU, one of the 256 you are using, you're just kicked out. And because cryo-EM softwares are not checking out on a very regular basis compared to many other applications, it has been very difficult to make use of that for us. And when we talked to the people running the cluster, they told us it's typical of national labs or supercomputer centers. So has anybody ever encountered that? And if yes, will you mind raising your hand? So we are two, FSU and UW and UCSD, okay. I don't know, if it's used more often, and if there is any interest, I think it could be very useful for us to adapt cryo-EM refinement software to that as well. Because sometimes you have thousands of CPUs sitting idle, but if your jobs are not checking out on a regular basis, you keep being kicked out and you restart from where you were and you never move forward. So for Rosetta, it works beautifully well. So I hope so far I convinced you that the combination of the Rosetta energy function that includes many more terms than most crystallographic softwares and the insertion of fragments that use the sequence structure relationship, Rosetta is very, very efficient and can allow you to determine structures in an automated way up to 4.8 or 4.5 angstrom resolution. The pipeline is very versatile. You have many, many different steps, and you are free to enter or exit at any time. So you can build by hand and refine in Rosetta. You can do everything with Rosetta and finish with Phoenix. It's absolutely up to you. Everything is open and freely available. And now I would like to share with you a few reflections about what we do to build maps, some small tricks, or how we validate them. And something we really like to do is to look at different maps to try to help us gaining confidence in what's going on. We typically do many classifications, so we have many subsets of particles, and each subset will lead to different maps with different level of noise. We also use different softwares, and sometimes it's very useful. And I'm getting back to this review article written by Ifan, Tom, Nico, and Powell, I believe, where so Nico reconstructed the TripV1 structure using FreeAlign and compared it to Reliant, and the two maps the two maps agreed largely, but there are always regions in one map that are better and the other map, other regions are better. And I think it's very, very useful to look at that. And the more you look at it, the more you can gain confidence or not in some regions. So we also very often use different bifactor sharpenings for different regions of the map. I know Powell developed SX filter local. I don't have experience personally with that, but we really like using different sharpening. And I took this very extreme example of the STIB structure I determined a while back when I was a postdoc. And as you can see, that the structure being very large and made of different components, proteins, lipids, the resolution is not the same across the structure. And here we can see that, for example, the capsid shell is very well defined, but the region of the membrane is shown in yellow is very, very smooth. And so we used, it was way before the movie mode, but so we were using at that time a bifactor of 400 square angstrom negative to properly restore features in the capsid shell region that you can see is very well defined, and the resolution was much better than 4 here. But for example, if we look at the transmembrane protein, the resolution was much, much lower than 4. And a bifactor of that value will just enhance the noise and make the map much worse. And that time we used 100 square angstrom negative value to just being able to see second noise structural elements. And this is a very extreme example, but in many maps, I think it's very useful to look at different bifactors. And I strongly encourage everybody to try it. So I was wondering if we should discuss of which maps should we deposit on the 3DEM or CCPEM mailing list. Someone recently brought up the topic, and I thought it was very interesting. So typically, we deposit the full map that is sharpened. Sometimes we deposit unsharpened map. I know Ifan did that for the TripV1 channel, and we did it for the LLIK channel. So the caveat is that it requires people to know how to sharpen their map. But do we want to deposit the half maps and the masks used for resolution estimation or for reconstruction, as has been suggested on the 3DEM, CCPEM? Maybe if you are interested, we can discuss about that in a few minutes. So how do we validate the model? And I apologize in advance. I think the next two slides will overlap largely with what Wa has shown. Our model needs to make stereochemical sense. So we have very nice servers such as Model Probity that are showing us how a model is in agreement or not with stereochemical knowledge, such as Bayesian statistics, bond length and angles. And here I'm showing an example of how it looks when it looks good. Everything is green, but if you look at the values, you can see that Bayesian unfavored are way above 97, 98%. I can't read from here. The very few, if any, disallowed Bayesian outliers. But when things are not going well, it can look like that. And this is obviously what we want to avoid. And we can always use the server, improve the structure, and go back, and so on and so forth. So EM Ringer has been discussed earlier, which is also a very useful tool developed by Jamie Frazier's lab. And we love glycans, so we use Privateer, developed by John Aguirre at the University of York. We know what hexoses should look like. And as for proteins, unless the density clearly tells us it's different, such as for a very high resolution structure of trypsin or chymotrypsin showing the catalytic serine in a different region of the Ramachandran space, and it's important for catalysis, but in 99.9% of the examples, we are not in this situation, and we should just agree with the prior knowledge. So that is very important, but we don't need data for that, right? If you use a good force field, you can generate a protein structure without any data. So you should also agree with the density. I'm showing examples. So you should be able to, your sequence should be satisfied when fit into the density. If possible, you do not have any unmodeled regions or unaccounted for, sorry, regions not unmodeled. Half maps are very useful when we observe water molecules in the proteasome. At the time, Ifan suggested this because water molecules are very small and can very easily be mistaken for noise or vice versa. Do you see them in the half maps? And so we're very happy to see that in the half maps, they were at the same location. And Ifan touched on that during his talk the first day. And in that case, we also had crystal structures that were cross-validating that. But the model should be cross-validated using any information that has not been used during the refinements. So if we use a force field with Ramachandran statistics, for example, the Ramachandran plot is going to look good, but it doesn't tell you anything because you use that information during the refinement. So it's good that it looks good, but it's not enough. You need to use information that has not been used during the refinement. And this concept has been introduced a long time ago with R3 by Axel Brunger. where when you measure diffraction intensities, it's much easier to set aside a few percent of your reflection that you never use during model building and refinement. And at every single stage, you see how well your model agrees with this reflection that have been set aside. Frank DiMaio proposed to use FSC work and FSC free, which is conceptually equivalent, but it takes half of your data. You build a model as well described, in one of the half map from the refinement being gold standard or not. And then you compare using the second map, calculating an FSC, and you don't want to see too much divergence. My experience is that it's a good test, but I don't think it's super stringent. I'll be happy to hear people's opinion if they think the same or differently. And so what is typical for us is because the full map has more information than the half maps, although both half maps agree to the determined resolution, we do a last step in the full map, only doing minimization, no large changes. I think at the LMB, Garib introduced the use of refining everything with one map, and at the end you shake your model and re-refine the two half maps and see how well they correlate, which is also a measure of this kind of agreement. But again, a 3-5 angstrom resolution is not always that easy, and any other information that one might have is useful. And so usually when you work on a protein, you care about specific biological questions and you have information about it. We are lucky with glycoproteins, we see glycans. And when we see them in the density, and we always cross-validate using mass spec, so we are very happy because it's a very good encode we see throughout the map. And earlier I showed you proteins covered with more than 100 glycans, so it's a lot of constraints. And if it doesn't agree, mass spec plus density should allow us to correct for that. We also have proteins with disulfide bonds, and they are very well resolved in density in many, many cases. We never enforce anything for disulfide bonds during model building. So when we end up with two cysteines facing each other and density accounting for it, it suggests that we're doing well. But again, if you work on a specific protein, it's because you care about it, and you probably know things. You might have cross-linking mass spec data or any other kind of data. Cross-linking mass spec can be incorporated into Rosetta CM. It's just a text file, it's very easy, and it restrains the refinements. So to conclude, I would like to introduce a new approach that I think is pretty amazing, developed in David Baker's lab in my department at the University of Washington. And I went to the thesis defense of Sergei Ochinnikov, and I was really blown away by what you can do with the concept of co-evolution. So if you have a protein with many orthologs sequence in many organisms, if you align all these sequences, you will see that you have residues that are varying together. They are co-varying. When one is mutated, the other one is mutated. And you can actually use this information as distance constraints, because usually if they co-vary together, it's because they are close in space and even interacting. So this approach has been used very successfully in the Baker lab to predict protein structures with an unprecedented accuracy, and for proteins that were totally out of range of homology modeling before that. And I think of these restraints that you find here a bit similar to NMR structural determination. And this is an example of what they did. On the left-hand side is the structure they predicted. On the right is the crystal structure that was held for the CAS contest. And as you can see, it's pretty damn good. So when I listened to the defense, I was thinking, we should probably be able to use this information as a cross-validation tool. The sequences are available. And if you solve a new structure, and if you have enough sequences available in databases, you can derive this matrix of distances and see how well your structure agrees with that. It doesn't cost anything. It's just like an extra step as more probability, no more experiments. So we're going to be looking at thresholds. If you take high resolution structures and compare how many violations you see for a set of known structures, we can establish what a good threshold will be. And if you violate more than the threshold, maybe you should go back to the structure and try to understand why it happens. So the current limitation is that most sequences available in databases are for prokaryotic organisms, but with metagenomics, more and more sequences are becoming available, and that could be more widely applicable. So how do we deal with uncertainty in model building? So, yes. Oh, we are past, okay. So I think I have one slide left. So we can left a region unmodeled. You can let the bifactor account for it. You can truncate the sidechain as C-beta, as I said, or set the occupancy to zero. Or you can use any combination of those, and I think depending on the situation, if you start with a known model that you are refining, or if you build de novo, you might favor one over the other. But these discussions have been going on CCP4BB for decades, and I don't think anybody agrees on something. And I think a very important point is that at the end of the day, just say what you have done in the manuscript to help people seeing what's going on. And my last slide, we use model convergence from the Rosetta outputs to judge how well we trust regions. And Mark Herzig and Gabe Lander developed a very nice server that also does that automatically for you, whether you want it or not. And you can see here the references in BioArchive, and I'm hoping that they will publish in another journal very soon. And here is the link if you want. And we also like to compare agreement between the refined B factor and the resolution in the map. So I would like to thank the people in my lab who determined all the structures I showed you, and our collaborators, and especially Frank DiMaio and Brandon Friends, who developed all the tools I presented today. And we feel very fortunate to work with them to be able to use these tools and push the developments forward. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, and have a couple of quick questions.
Hi, over here. I have a quick question, and maybe I just missed it. How does Rosetta count for like alpha helixes? You mentioned there's something for beta sheets, and it does these fragments, but how do you consider when you have like a long segment that it's an alpha chain to like put it consistent rather than fragments? How does it put it all together?
So the approach is always based on the principle of these fragments that you insert. And the specification I made about beta strains was just because they are more difficult to model. So for Rosetta, yes, there is a special implementation to try to help building beta strains. Alpha helices are not that hard, and you don't have to implement specific features for that. The fragments account very well for that. When you predict based on the 9 residue window, you get them right all the time.
So thanks, David. So I understand that Rosetta does everything in real space, and we've also had a lot of success with Rosetta. But there's a lot of packages out there, and I'm wondering if there's a consensus in the field as to whether or not we refine in real space or in Fourier space.
Real space. Stay in real space. If you're a real space map, you can stay in real space.
I mean, yeah, the argument in crystallography, you want to refine against your raw data, so you refine in reciprocal space. Here, we don't really refine against the raw data per se. We refine against the raw data after processing and leading to a map. But yeah, I'm also very much in favor of real space. And actually, I think most of these softwares, one way or the other, not all, I believe RefMac is still doing reciprocal space. Maybe Shoji can confirm. But even Phoenix, who has both options, I think for cryo-EM refinement, is mostly focusing on real space now. Someone can contradict me if I'm wrong. It's still switching back and forth between both?
Yeah.
Okay. I believe you have the option to do only real space if you want, though.
No, if you refine B factor,
oh, if you refine B factor, okay. Yeah. I mean, because the formula of B factor, I mean, Frank developed a formalism for B factor in real space, but obviously B factor otherwise does not have a real sense in real space.
Thomas?
David, the co-evolution approach that you mentioned, I think, is really powerful on the one hand. But on the other hand, you showed a structure that undergoes really dramatic conformational changes, right? Mm-hmm. Can you actually also use basically co-evolution constraints in order to model that conformational changes?
I hope so. I haven't yet gotten David to look at that problem. But yes, these kind of conformational changes, I think, will always be a challenge for prediction. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'd like to make another pitch for the co-evolution constraint. In work we did with Alexei a couple of years ago, and then subsequent papers, we actually used it to build a model for cryo-EM map at around 7 angstroms, and we subsequently solved the structure at sub 4 angstroms, and it turns out the models were absolutely indistinguishable. So it does work well. You need to have a fair number of sequences, so mitochondrial proteins work well, bacterial proteins work well. It gets harder when you get to more exotic mammalian proteins. So the power of the technique goes up with multiple sequence alignment. Rosetta allows for adding those constraints as a file in your model building. We were never able to figure out how to use that, but it would be very good for someone who can.
So, I mean, what you said about co-evolution, I mean, I know Frank and David helped Tom Rappaport's lab recently to determine structure, I think, with Mao Fu Liao, and that worked as well. But that also applies for the other tools in Rosetta. It predicts sometimes when you don't have great density sidechain conformations, and when you solve higher resolution structure, most of the time it was right. So it's really filling in information. I'm not saying it's foolproof. Nothing is foolproof. And it's better to have a two-action map than a four-action map. But it's very, very powerful.
Question here. So do you have a way to deal with the anisotropic map resolution for modeling? Particularly in one direction, you have good confidence built about the model. However, the other direction is very poor. But by taking the advantage of the some biological constraint which you modeled and do a better modeling for the other direction.
So far, there is nothing implemented. I mean, an isotropic map will just be a poorer map for all data or for you when you try to build. Some regions will appear worse just because of the anisotropy. And so these tools will try to deal with that as well as possible, but with nothing specifically geared towards the anisotropy.